Hey everybody, I'm Garrett.
And I'm Melissa.
We've been married for 8 years and have two kids, Caleb and Sadie.
Over the last few years, we have fallen in love with the scriptures and are learning how digging into God's word has helped us grow deeper with each other and those around us.
We want to be real about our lives, our struggles, and our joys.
This is Growing Deeper.
Hey guys, before we get to the podcast, just want to remind you to rate and review the podcast. That'll make sure that if somebody looks up Exodus or Ruth, that they will be able to pull up our podcast and see what we have to say on different sections of the Bible. Also, if you have any questions or comments or things that you want to share with us, you can email us now. We now have an email address of growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. That's growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you, even just saying, hey, we're listening and really appreciate it or something like that. I don't know. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Now on to the podcast.
Hey guys. So like we mentioned on the last podcast, it's been a really crazy past, I guess, month. February has absolutely flown by. Mm-hmm. So it all started at the very end of January, us making an offer on a new house. And that was crazy for us to do, to make a decision so quickly. And it all has to do with, or part of the reason for the move is, Caleb's school and where we want him to go to school. But there's been, I think, a surprising amount of emotional stress.
And don't forget COVID on top of that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Don't forget, we've all had COVID. Yes. The kids actually ended up coming back testing positive. They never had any symptoms, though. Garrett had probably the roughest. His case was rough, I made light
of it last time.
I know, like last time he was like totally fine.
And then next week was pretty rough.
He like collapsed. I forgot how.
Yeah, I basically had a whole day where I just like couldn't move. And just my whole body hurt and everything. And for me, my symptoms changed daily. It was something. I went from like headache and fever, which was whenever we did the podcast last time, I was kind of pushing through that, having a little bit of a cough, and then it just changed to like full body aches, which was like kind of debilitated me, and then it changed to the no taste, no smell, all that stuff, and then all of that on top of us trying to get the house ready for mm-hmm. selling, and because we're going to be moving to another house, and so mm-hmm. we're trying to get our house ready to show and everything like that, and then I have COVID on top of that, so it's just...
I think there was about a month where we had at least one person in our house that was in quarantine for mm-hmm. either exposure or actually testing positive, and so during that month, I think there was 2 days where we thought we were safe, where we were out of our quarantine, and that's when we bought the house.
Yeah.
And so then, and that was, early on, so like... After that, trying to figure out how to meet with people safely, because we have been very big on, obviously, we wanted the COVID to stop with us and not spread it to someone else. And so just figuring out, Garrett would like leave with the kids once I was out of quarantine so that the realtor could come over, or just like figuring out logistics like that has just been obviously harder than it should be.
Right.
And then just, we hinted at this last time, but it has really been an emotional struggle for us too. Because we love our current house.
Yeah.
We've
had a lot of things happen in this house, between bringing home two kids and then, obviously it was our first house. So mm-hmm. like me and you remember the very first night that we had here, where we had nothing in the house, we had just closed on it and everything. And I remember it was a torrential downpour and thunder, lightning, and everything.
We were so desperate to sleep in this house. We slept in this house without our bed here.
We slept on the floor.
We slept on the floor in our room, and we listened to the rain, and there were frogs outside.
Yeah.
And you could just hear nature, and it was amazing.
And so you have memories like that where... it's like that's really the first time that me and you felt like we were in a home together. We had been in an apartment, but we moved here, and then it felt like we actually had a home.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's just a lot of, I mean, and all the excitement that went with that. And yeah. And so all of those things are, you know, part of this house and part of how we feel about it, you know. Mm-hmm. And so where there is really exciting things, I think, on the horizon and, you know, things that we want to do to the new house and make it what it could be and what we want it to be. At the same time, you're leaving your first home. Mm-hmm. And in all the things that go with that, I just find myself like looking out the window staring, you know, there's like a pond across the street for us and it's got a fountain and I'm just like, oh, I can't believe we're leaving this.
That's like the view from his office or from our bonus room that he's been using as his office. So, I mean, it has shocked me in some ways how much it has just like where we've just gotten really sad together about leaving. And it's not, I think that something that I've learned through this process is that just because change is hard doesn't mean it's not the right decision. Because I still do think we're absolutely making the right decision. And once we can actually focus on our new house, I think we're going to really be, you know, excited about that and thinking about all the things that we're going
to
do.
Making that your home as opposed to, you know, as opposed to this place. And
yeah.
But, you know, yeah, there's just lots of things, lots of emotions that go with that, and that's hard sometimes. Yeah. And change is hard, and it's not exactly enjoyable. I don't like anything about this process of selling our house. And
it's stressful.
All of it just stresses you out because you're, you know, every minute you're wondering, well, is it going to fall through? Are we going to start this over again or whatever? And, you know, it's like, you know, it'll be okay if that happens, but you know, you worry about that stuff and mm-hmm. it's just a overall difficult process. It's already emotional as it is.
Yeah. I mean, I think too, just like, I don't know, thinking about the Christmases we've spent here mm-hmm. and how we had dreamed about those Christmases when we first looked at this house.
Yeah.
It just makes it when you start really digging into all the things you're going to leave behind here, it just gets really emotional.
Yeah.
And thankfully, I think we are starting to get to the point of accepting that.
I'm sure there's going to be moments.
Yeah. Like
in the future. Like whenever we're pulling out of here.
Oh, yeah. There will definitely be moments. But I feel like I have a better sense of peace about everything now and a better sense of hope.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, we are really excited about our new house. There's a lot of things about it that this house will never have or could never have
mm-hmm.
that the new house does have. And so that's going to be exciting to, you know, make our own.
Right.
But it's not our own yet. Yeah. So until then, we wait.
Yeah.
Which kind of leads us into...
Yeah. So, I mean, for the first time, I think, what, in 6 months or something?
Maybe more than that.
Yeah. We actually, we went and worshiped with the church today, which has been something that we've really missed for a long time. And, you know, we're trying our best to follow COVID protocols and everything like that. And, but now that we've had it, you know, and we're through the other side, we made the decision that we were going to go back and worship with other brothers and sisters and people that, you know, we've known for a really long time and we haven't seen for months and months.
And I mean,
months.
To be clear, we were going to like a house church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
garage
true.
Church.
Yes.
So we just mean at the church building. It is something we haven't done in a while. But the downside to house church is that we are limited in what we can do with the kids as far as like, you know, I and, you know, me or Garrett have to, you know, kind of watch them. And when they're at somebody's house, they feel a little bit freer. I don't know. They just want to run. And it's pretty much always been outside, like a garage and stuff. So the kids will want to run around and play. And so it's hard for me to focus and, and really be there. And so now they have an option by going back to the church building for at least Caleb to have a kids class mm-hmm. and be
which
a part
is ultimately
of that.
What we really saw. I mean, we just realized that, you know, maybe we weren't able to do certain things for Caleb that we really think he needs.
Yeah.
And so that was a big, that was a major aspect of that decision, which
and,
was,
and even just, know. I mean, when you consider, you start to consider the, like the percentage of Sadie's life that she hasn't gone to the church building, and you just start to go, like, I don't want her to all of a sudden be like, what are we doing here? Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
And so, it's just important to us to try to point them in that direction. She's not quite big enough for the kids class that they have yet, but she will be soon.
Yeah.
And so she, but just getting used to her just, you know, being in a pew and just kind of like, I think it forces her to pay a little bit more attention to like what's going on around her and stuff. Mm-hmm. So that was really good. And we saw people we hadn't seen in forever, and our kids got to play with old friends, and it was, it left us with an incredible sense of hope.
Yeah.
And, I mean, do you want to talk a little bit about the lesson today?
Yeah, I mean, and for us where we are, the things that we were talking about as far as the house is concerned, I mean, what the lesson that we got today was about being patient and about being learning how to wait, and, you know, trusting in God that things are going to be taken care of. And these are things that, like, you know, mm-hmm. I guess, but yeah. It, there's something about being reminded of it in that moment that you need it.
Yeah.
And for us, I mean, I know that we spent the whole day yesterday, you know, like being like, well, what's the response going to be for this? And yeah. like, I just want to get it over with. I yeah. want to be done. And
so like the process is you have like these list of repairs that these people want. And so it's like they make the list, give it to their realtor. Their realtor seems to take their precious time to get it yeah. to our realtor. Our realtor seems to take his precious time to get it to us. And I'm sure that's not the case, but it feels this way.
Yeah.
And then we get it. We respond to it. And then we're waiting for their response. And we don't know where it is in the process. And it's driving us crazy.
Yeah.
And to you know, we've spent a lot of time worrying about things like that and not just like going, okay, we've done what we can do. Let's enjoy our day.
Right. And put trust in God. Yeah. I mean, that's something, again, that we know intellectually, but it's really hard to live out and have that true wisdom of saying, yeah, we've done everything that we can and we're going to put everything in God's hands from here, you know, like, that he's going to, regardless of what happens, not even saying that we're, you know, like we think that, you know, God's going to make everything positive for us. And that's not necessarily the case, but at the same time, trusting that, you know, where we're going to head with this is going to be good for us, regardless of what the circumstances are. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that was a much needed, it really was. It was much needed for us to hear, you know, a reminder of that, listen, you know, God is for us, you know, it's not that, again, that he's going to give us everything that we ever want, but he's going to be with us in these moments and we need to put trust in him and know that he is for our good. And so that was just a much needed reminder as we're going through all of this house stuff. And so,
mm-hmm.
Just very much appreciated that. And yeah, again, it's just we left with this renewed sense of hope and feeling like, you know, things could, they'll never be quote normal again, but that, you know, that there is some sense of rebirth, you know, that's mm-hmm. on the horizon, that we feel like is coming, and knowing that, and just being able to see our friends and being able to see people that we haven't seen in months. And not that we haven't been able to see friends before with the house church. It's just that we were able to see different ones and be renewed in those relationships in a way that needed to be renewed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I felt like it kind of revitalized us a little bit when we were kind of feeling down about things that were going on. And,
mm-hmm.
Feeling frustrated, even though nothing's necessarily is negative that's happening.
In fact, most of it's been positive. Yeah. And we sit and look at each other like,
why are we
feeling so yeah. like anxious and worried yeah. when everything is going perfectly? Because something that I don't think we pointed out was our house sold in one day.
Right.
was under contract in one day. Yeah. And it's an amazing market if you want to sell your house. Unfortunately, if you want to buy a house, they're
not a great market.
But so I mean, like, we had, you know, multiple offers in one day, and so it was just like this incredible thing, and then here we are stressing about it. And so it's like we just trying to refocus and be thankful, be present. It's been something we've been working on.
So we're going to transition now into, like Melissa said, the most exhilarating chapter in the whole Bible. I don't think that's really I'll be honest with you, this is the hardest, like, this might be the hardest chapter I've ever had to get through. And since whenever I started reading chapter by chapter stuff and doing studies over that, this might be the hardest chapter I've had to get through. And so, you know, I just want to come to grips with that and understand that and see that. And, but also try to, we need to go after it, and we need to see, you know, what it is about this, that this teaches us about God. This is like the thing that Peter N said last time, is that, this isn't necessarily how do I apply this to my life. This is about what does this tell me about God and his nature, and who, what it's like to come into contact with this God. And so
this isn't a hard chapter in the sense of, oh my goodness, what do we do with this, you know, fire, angry mountain God sense type of thing, you know?
Fire, angry mountain
God. I don't know what you usually say.
Holy fire mountain God. Sorry. He's not angry.
Oh, well, I mean, I'm talking about the perspective that people normally have about.
Okay,
so it's not hard in the sense of like, oh, God seems so like mad and destructive. It's hard in the sense of we're basically reading, like, imagine reading the instruction manual for putting together a crib.
Bike. I don't know. But yeah. Anything.
So, like, it's like, yeah, anything that has a lot of parts.
Yeah.
A dresser. I mean, I don't know.
I kind of like read manuals for a living. So, I mean, it's those are hard. Interesting. You don't just sit there and go through stuff like for kicks, you know, like you need to have like a reason for going to it and reading for it to be interesting.
I mean, because a lot of times, if we're honest, though, you might do that for work, but if we're putting together something for the kids, you wait as long as possible to look at the manual.
That's true.
So,
and then I end up with like parts at the end, and I'm like, "What? Where was this supposed to go?" And then I realize I put on a board backwards, and I'm like, "Ah, darn it!" And I have to go back and redo everything because I put one board on backwards.
Do we need this piece? No, I think it's fine. It's fine.
So I imagine the readers, you know, like you know, them going through this, maybe the instruction and trying to put it together, like, did somebody get a frame backwards and have to I don't know, but
yeah, we'll get into that.
So anyways, I want to approach this in the way that maybe, you know, try to do what it was intended to do, which is to tell us something about God, and also you know, come to grips with why this might be boring to me, but it wouldn't be boring to somebody else. Why would this not be boring to an ancient Israelite? And what did they see in it that was beautiful? And I think that, you know, when they would read this, you know, in synagogue or, you know, in their gatherings, and they would eat it up and they would love it. And I think they would. And so what is it about it that they loved that might help bring out some of that to me? And so it's detailed. It feels detailed, but then again, it's not detailed enough to actually go do the stuff sometimes. And so that's kind of an interesting thing. But again, what is this telling me about God? And last time, you know, we went over three different parts, three different units that go into the tabernacle, which is the ark, the lampstand, and the table. And those are three different parts. It's interesting. There's one other part inside the tabernacle that's not mentioned. And I want to get to that at some point. I don't want to get ahead of myself with this, but there's one other thing that's in the tabernacle, that's going to be built, but hasn't been mentioned yet. But anyways, those three things go into the tabernacle. We talked about kind of what their purposes are, and what they're doing, or maybe what they symbolize in the tabernacle. And now we're actually going to get to the tabernacle itself. And so, again, not exactly exhilarating reading, but we're going to read it, and we're going to see, you know, what are some things that come to us about what is it, what is this God like? What does this tell us about what this God is like, and why would this be important for that? So let's read this first section here.
Make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of finely twisted linen and blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, with cherubim worked into them by a skilled craftsman. All the curtains are to be the same size, 28 cubits long and 4 cubits wide. Join 5 of the curtains together and do the same with the other 5. Make loops of blue material along the edge of the end curtain in one set, and do the same with the end curtain in the other set. Make 50 loops on one curtain and 50 loops on the end curtain of the other set, with the loops opposite each other. Then make 50 gold clasps and use them to fasten the curtains together so that the tabernacle is a unit. Make curtains of goat hair for the tent over the tabernacle, 11 altogether. All 11 curtains are to be the same size, 30 cubits long and 4 cubits wide. Join 5 of the curtains together into one set and the other 6 into another set. Fold the 6th curtain double at the front of the tent. Make 50 loops along the edge of the end curtain in one set and also along the edge of the end curtain in the other set. Then make 50 bronze clasps and put them in the loops to fasten the tent together as a unit. As for the additional length of the tent curtains, the half curtain that is left over is to hang down at the rear of the tabernacle. The tent curtains will be a cubit longer on both sides. What is left will hang over the sides of the tabernacle so as to cover it. Make for the tent a covering of ram skins dyed red, and over that a covering of hides of sea cows.
Okay, so we have this whole section about the curtains.
Curtains so, for days.
Yeah, lots of curtains. Curtains on curtains. And so the description that we got is finely twisted linen that's purple, you know, blue, purple, crimson. And interworked on that is going to be the cherubim. And so I guess, so here's what I think what I want to do is try to, like, we're just trying to picture in our mind's eye of what is it like to go into this? Like we talked about last time, what's it like to walk into the tabernacle? Well, if there's no lampstand, it's going to be dark. Why? Mm-hmm. Because you've got layers on layers of these things. You've got, like, okay, the purple, the blue, purple, crimson, linen. And then on top of that is the goat hair. On top of that is, you know, another layer of some sort of leather, and then another layer of leather.
So basically, if you have a baby, these are the type of, like, blackout curtains that you need so that they will nap during the day and think that it is nighttime.
So the only light getting into this place, the only light that's in this place, is the light from the lampstand. And then also picture have you ever had the lights go out, maybe, and you light a candle, and if that candle is the only light in the room in the middle of the night, like, what does that light look like? You know, and it's kind of flickering and changing, and you just, like, maybe shadows and stuff are changing in the room, like, continually, mm-hmm. and stuff. And sometimes it feels like things are moving, you know, like whenever you have just the candlelight, mm-hmm. feels like things are kind of moving. And so picture whenever you go into this place, and I think you would be able to see the curtains on the top. So you would look up and you would see these curtains that are blue, purple, and crimson that are interwoven together, and interlaced in them is the cherubim. And I guess I picture the cherubim kind of being this gold, I don't know, it's just kind of how I'm picturing it, that they're kind of like this gold look to them because they're like these divine beings. Or whatever, you would look up and you would see them interlaced on that, and then they would be flickering in the light, you know, of the lampstand, which is the only light in the room. And so it's almost, I picture it almost giving this, like, lifelike moving feeling to the cherubim that are both above you as well as in front of you on the curtain, that's separating you from the most holy place, which we'll get to. But, it's almost like that, you know, this flickering light, that is, causing things that are maybe stationary to look like they're kind of alive. It's like you're walking into the heavens. And I think that's the picture that you're supposed to be getting, is that you're walking into, again, the throne room of God.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just want, if maybe we can picture that, we can see how surreal this feels.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's all interlocked together so that like nothing penetrates, nothing comes in, nothing goes out.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing is the light that's on the inside, which is also representative of God's holy presence that's there. Illuminating everything in this new creation. So maybe that will help us some as to understanding this, of what its purpose is. And again, it's like this separating barrier that makes it so that God can dwell among them without reaching out and killing them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's this dividing curtain.
So something that I wanted to mention that I had noticed when we were reading through this was, in the last chapter, we kind of talked about how everything seemed to have like handles or of some sort or something to be able, not necessarily handles, but just the poles stuck out in a way where it would be easy for them to carry.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of going on with that theme of like this, the idea of these things being very mobile.
Yeah.
Curtains, while these are super thick, heavy duty curtains are still easier to move than a building.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
Keeping in mind that this is, I mean, it even refers to it as like a tent. And so thinking about how you can, a purpose of a tent is, you can pick it up and move and go to multiple places with it. And so I think that there's a lot of significance with that, especially with this this idea of taking God's presence to other places.
Mm-hmm.
And not just keeping it in one spot where everybody has to maybe try to come to it. It's so that God can be anywhere,
right,
and in our presence, and how ultimately through Jesus we become tabernacles.
So we'll get to that. So the whole point of this is so that it's God's mobile unit that he can be in with his people as they go into the promised land. Now, there is going to be a point where the idea is that it's in this one central location, that's the temple, that is a building.
Yeah.
But in order for God's not, see here, I mean, what's interesting is God's not like, hey, go to the promised land and build me a temple there, right? Mm-hmm. He's taking them there.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to go with them, and his divine presence with them is what's so important.
Yeah, he wants to be with them through the whole journey.
It's life with God in the wilderness is much better than life without God in the land.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to hit that. At some point, Moses is going to be very adamant about that. Of like, no, you're going to go with us. If you don't go with us, we're not going. And so there's this huge importance on God being dwelling in and among his people, that he's not just saying from Sinai, hey, go there, I'll meet you there.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, go there and I'm going with you. And not only am I going with you, I'm going before you.
Mm-hmm.
And so the mobile aspect of this is really important. And then it's important to John, whenever Jesus arrives on the scene, that he says that the Word became flesh and it tabernacled among us. And so that's what Jesus is doing. He's this tabernacle of God's presence that's going around throughout the Galilee, that's, bringing heaven to earth.
That's
uniting these two places, that, that God's kingdom is coming down and dwelling among humanity through the person of Jesus. And so now he's this mobile tabernacle, and he would even say, I'm the temple, mm-hmm. which was highly offensive at the time, whenever you have a temple that's sitting over there in Jerusalem. And so anyways, all of that to say, John very much sees Jesus as this mobile tabernacle of God's dwelling on earth. He uses that language very specifically to do that. But anyways, there's this mobile aspect to it. Another thing that's really cool here as the all of these, you've got the curtains and you've got the loops and all of this stuff, the class that are going between them, and what are the purposes of all those things? It's so that the tabernacle will be one. That's what it says in chapters or in verse 6 here. Make it all together so that they're unified and they. You said the it's, so it's
it
a
says,
unit.
It says a unit, and in my version it says that twice, and so I
right.
That's so interesting of that coming up twice in just this.
Yeah. So verse 6 it says so that the tabernacle will be one. And then in verse 11, and you will make 50 bronze clasps and put the clasps on the loops and join the tent so that it will be one. And all of it is about this unified piece. Like it's all like individual pieces that are all unified together to create the holy dwelling of God. That's going to be important. But it's to me. So again, it's like this idea of like, if it's not all unified together, it can't perform its function. It can't perform its function without its individual aspects. And part of that function is to create this barrier so that God doesn't break out and, you know, that his holiness goes out and, you know, destroys some of the Israelites, in the nuclear business. I mean, there's lots of layers that we have between nuclear fuel and everything else. Anyway, sometimes with radiation, you have what's called shine. If there's a highly radioactive piece of something, and let's say you have like a cement wall that goes around it that protects whatever, but sometimes you need to make holes through that wall to, you know, transport cable or something like that through it. Sometimes what you can do is you'll have a highly radioactive thing in the middle, but they're through those holes, if you walk by them, you'll pick up what's called radioactive shine. Which is it'll break out from its container and hit you, which is not desirable. But you pick up this shine because something's not blocking the radiation the way that it's supposed to be. And so that's kind of what, like, these things are like protecting the people from God's holiness and separating that out. So there's some aspect of it that God is dwelling among his people, but he's not going to do it in a way that's going to kill them. You know, and if this thing doesn't perform its function of doing that separation, if it's not a unified whole, then it can't protect. It both can't protect the people, which ultimately keeps God from being to dwell among his people. And so all of that unity becomes really, really, really important. And so for me, I read this and I see a lot of things being hit on in the future. But anyways, we will get to that. I think I'll just hit on that at the end. But anyways, unified whole is being the kind of purpose to all these different things and how important that is. You have any other thoughts on this section?
I don't think so.
Okay.
And you pick up in verse 15.
Verse 15?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So buckle up. Here we go. And you will make the frames for the tabernacle of acacia wood as uprights. The length of the frame will be 10 cubits, and the width of the one frame will be 1.5 cubits. And you will make two pegs for the one frame for joining each to another, and likewise for all the frames of the tabernacle. And you will make the frames for the tabernacle with 20 frames for the south side. And you will make 40 silver bases under the 20 frames, with two bases under the one frame for its two pegs, and two bases under the next frame for its two pegs. And for the second side of the tabernacle, the north side, there will be 20 frames, and there are 40 silver bases, with two bases under the one frame and two bases under the next frame. And for the rear of the tabernacle on the west, you will make 6 frames. And you will make two frames for the tabernacle corners at the rear, and they will be double at the bottom, and they will be completely together on its top to the one ring. It will be likewise for the two of them. They will be for the two corners, and there will be 8 frames and their silver bases, 16 bases, with two bases under the one frame and two bases under the next frame. You will make 5 bars of acacia wood for the frames on the one side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the frames on the second side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the frames on the side of the tabernacle at the rear on the west. And the bar in the middle, in the midst of the frames, will run from end to end. And you will overlay the frames with gold, and you will make their rings of gold as holders for the bars, and you will overlay the bars with gold, and you will erect the tabernacle according to its plan, which you have been shown on the mountain. And you will make a curtain of blue and purple and crimson yarns and finely twisted linen, the work of a skilled craftsman. He will make it with cherubim. And you will put it on four acacia pillars overlaid with gold, and with their gold hooks on four silver bases. And you will put the curtain under the clasp, and you will bring the Ark of the Testimony there inside the curtain. And the curtain will separate for you between the holy and the most holy place. And you will put the atonement cover on the Ark of the Testimony in the most holy place. And you will place the table outside the curtain and the lampstand opposite the table on the south side of the tabernacle. And you will put the table on the north side. And you will make for the entrance of the tent a screen of blue and purple and crimson yarns and finely twisted linen, the work of an embroiderer. And you will make for the screen five acacia pillars, and you will overlay them with gold with their gold hooks, and you will cast for them five bronze bases. All right. So
okay, what a chapter.
Does everybody have that pictured in their mind now as to what in the world's going on there? Yeah.
Frames and bases.
Yeah, so lots of frames. That's going to be, I guess, kind of the walls of the tabernacle. I think one thing's interesting. You're given the direction of the tabernacle here. It's kind of elusive, but you realize that the rear is at the west, and so it's facing east, which again very much hints back to the Garden of Eden, which is whenever they're cast out, they go out east. Mm-hmm. They go east of Eden. And so whenever you come back into the tabernacle, or the, you're coming back into the new, this new Garden of Eden, you're coming from east to west. And that's a very common thing in the Bible. Whenever you see somebody going east, that's not good. Usually, whenever somebody is going east, they're going into exile. Primarily Babylon is in the east. And so anytime somebody's going out towards the east, it's usually a symbol of exile. Anybody coming back west, primarily crossing over the Jordan from east to west, is coming back into the land and entering God's presence. So you'll see that happen with like David. Whenever David flees, he crosses back over the Jordan, goes to the east side of the Jordan whenever he's running away. And then whenever he comes back, there's this big celebration. He passes back over the Jordan and they have this party. David is back, you know, out of exile. So anyways, that's one thing that I just noticed offhand as we look at this. But yeah, so there's different frames and all this stuff, the things that are holding it up. It's not really clear how exactly all of it gets held up, but there's all these acacia wood bars and things like that that are apparently there for structural purposes.
Mm-hmm.
But they're overlaid with gold, so it seems like maybe they're kind of running the length of the tabernacle. And then again, above that would be the yarn, or you know, the twisted linen that's got the cherubim on it, which they're mentioned again, for the curtain that separates from the holy place from the most holy place. They're interworked on the curtain that separates those two. So again, it's like this entering into the heavenly. It's the heavenly dwelling of earth, or of God on earth.
Mm-hmm.
So
the thing that I'm most noticed or could understand in this section was just about how it's like we're finally kind of getting like the blueprint of mm-hmm. the floor plan, if you will,
yep.
of the tabernacle, and having these separate spaces. It's kind of like I'm picturing how you lay out like the main level of a house, of like here's the kitchen and here's the living area and whatever, here's a laundry area or whatever. We're kind of seeing the separation of the holy place and the most holy place. And we've kind of, I think, referenced that in past podcasts and kind of seen that in past, I don't know, it's just come up before.
Mm-hmm.
But this is like the first time, I think, in scripture that we're really seeing this, where the curtain is coming in and separating these places, which obviously is going to take you forward to what we see with Jesus. And I think that we'll talk about that. But it also took me back to a few chapters back in Exodus when this whole time it's been designed for us to be the royal priesthood. And so even though that this doesn't say, you know, who's designated, we're not to the point yet of saying who's designated to go into the holy place or the most holy place. These things are all starting to kind of tie together in my mind, knowing what I know is coming, of just how, you know, only certain people were allowed in these places, you know, mm-hmm. in these different levels of the tabernacle. And so, like, to be a high priest or to be considered a royal priesthood would allow you more access. Yeah. And so the fact that we were designed to have the closest access to God that we could possibly have is just really cool, obviously. Yeah. And it's a neat reminder of how God is working towards this throughout the story.
Yeah.
And this is just a part of the journey to yeah. get to that.
Yeah. And part of this, too, is, I mean, it's going all the way back, again, to Genesis chapter 1, which we mentioned last time, but the seven and Yahweh spoke to, you know, that comes up. This is actually, this section of the and Yahweh spoke goes from 25 all the way to chapter 30. But you get the sense of what's happening here. You've got the curtains, and it's like God is separating out the different things in his world, in his new cosmos. Peter N says this, the precise measurements of the structure combined with the symbolism of the curtains and the furnishings are not without deep significance. The tabernacle seems to represent a microcosm of creation itself. The splendor and beauty of the materials used, fine fabrics, precious metals, and stones affirm the goodness of the created world. The precise and perfect dimensions of the tabernacle indicate a sense of order amid chaos. To think of the tabernacle as an act of cosmic recreation is precisely what the building of the tabernacle originally intended to convey. And so what he's saying here is the purpose of all of this is showing God reordering his good creation, mm-hmm. And recreating it. And so it's taking you all the way back to Genesis chapter 1 in showing you that even despite all the things that have happened since Genesis chapter 3, that even despite all of that, that God has this new creation that he's forming and ordering, and he wants to involve humanity in that. And in some way, they're this new Adam that is going to access God's presence and how important all of that is. And so it's both not the perfect aspect of that, but it's closer. You know, it's like mm-hmm. something that you can see the trend. Yeah. You can see where God's trying to go, and you know whether or not the Israel does that. I mean, that's the question as you read the story, is whether or not they can continue in that path. But yeah, there's supposed to be this royal priesthood, which is ultimately what, and they're priest kings, which is what Adam was supposed to be, this intercessor for the world, intercessing with God on behalf of the world. And so you kind of get that sense of that this is, you know, this is both looking forward as well as remembering, you know, of where we came from and what our purpose, what our original purpose was, and showing that, hey, God's trying to enter us back into that, or he's doing that for Israel with the hopes of the nations on the horizon, mm-hmm. That they're going to be able to do that. So you have any other thoughts on this? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, again, I hinted at this earlier of, as far as everything being, unified and together. I think that these are very important phrases, especially for Peter and Paul. I think whenever they would write their letters, to the early church, this type of thing was very important to them. Especially as to what they, how they viewed the church. So I'll give one example. Well, I'll give a couple examples. But if Ephesians chapter 2, Ephesians is all about the unity of both Jews and Gentiles coming together as one, and being unified that which was previously separated. It's not uniformity, but it is unity. He's amazed at how God has somehow torn down the hostility between the two groups that was generated by not fulfilling the law. But anyways, he's overcome with how these two groups of people have come together. And this is like I'll read a section of Ephesians chapter 2 and where he gets into this. I mean, and you can read the unity language all throughout it, but I'll say, in coming, he proclaimed the good news of peace to you who were far away, and peace to the ones who were near. So he's talking about the Jews and the Gentiles being those that were far away and the Jews being those that were near. He proclaimed peace to all of them, because through him, we both have access to the one Spirit, in the one Spirit to the Father. Consequently, therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but you are fellow citizens of the saints and members of the household of God, built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, Christ Jesus himself being the cornerstone, in whom the whole building joined together grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are built up together into the dwelling place of God in the Spirit. And so what he's saying is that by what Jesus has done, these two have become one, much like man and woman unify together and become one. They're not necessarily distinct from each. They are distinct from each other still, mm-hmm. but yet, and somehow they're in this covenantal relationship. They've become one flesh. And he's saying, you guys are coming together, and the way that he uses it to describe it is that you're like this temple that's like being unified with each other in the holy dwelling place of God. And so the unity of the temple, that is God's dwelling on earth, it's this unifying place between heaven and earth. He's saying that you Jews and you Gentiles are that. You are this unifying place between heaven and earth. But if you're not unified, it destroys the tabernacle. That's what we, like, whenever we talk about what that section about the tabernacle being one, if it separates somehow, it's no longer able to perform its function. Mm-hmm. And so just the same, if we aren't unified, we can't perform our function as the holy temple of the Lord. Mm-hmm. And so he's using this language to show them, you are the holy dwelling of God on earth. But it's not you individually, it's you collectively. It's all of y'all. It's y'all that are the temple. All of us together as believers in Jesus, we're growing this holy temple unified together. So if we don't have unity, we're not doing a very good job of being the temple. That may be hard. You know, that's maybe hard to swallow. Yeah. Of the, you know, whenever we are, you know, again, it doesn't mean that you're not, like, that you fully agree with other people.
Right.
But there is a sense of, like, that somehow we can disagree with each other and still move forward. Mm-hmm. And still have this commonality that we believe, you know, that we trust in Messiah Jesus. That he's the Lord of heaven and earth, you know, that he's, everything has been summed up in him. Anyways, all that Ephesian language, or here in this is 1 Peter chapter 2, he says, therefore, ridding yourselves of all malice and all deceit and hypocrisy and envy and all slander, like newborn infants, long for the unadulterated spiritual milk, so that by it you may grow up to salvation, if you have tasted that the Lord is kind, to whom you are drawing near, a living stone rejected by men, but chosen and precious in the sight of God. And you yourselves, as living stones, are being built up as the spiritual house for the holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus the Messiah. And so he and Paul are on the same page here. But like he's saying that you collectively, y'all are the living stones that are building up this house. And again, if there's any part of the house that is not performing its function, it's not the whole thing, you know? It's not able to do its job. I wish y'all could see
Garrett's arm movements as he's building. It makes me realize, if you've ever talked to our son Caleb, he talks with his hands.
My son gets my mannerisms and whatever that I do. Yes, you were right.
Man, we really should maybe film a live recording of our podcast.
Yeah. But anyways, I'll hit one more and then we'll kind of close out. But this is from Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews has a lot of this stuff about the curtain. Again, the curtain comes up actually a lot. Mm-hmm, yeah. Of the curtain, all three synoptic gospels talk about the curtain that was split whenever Jesus died on the cross, and symbolizing and showing that, you know, God's dwelling among humanity, that in some way it was able to reach out from there. You know, reach out from the most holy place, and that it was now among humanity. And so anyways, there's a lot of levels to that, but the curtain that we talked about, that's got the cherubim on it was ripped in two at the death of Jesus. So that comes up. And then Hebrews chapter 10, I'll start in verse 19. It says, "Therefore, brothers, since we have confidence for the entrance into the sanctuary by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way which he inaugurated for us through the curtain that is his flesh." So he calls the curtain his flesh. And he says that now we are able, through the blood of Messiah, that through Jesus we can actually enter into this place. What was previously off limits to us, we now have the ability to go into it. And he says the curtain is the flesh of Jesus, which died and has been, you know, like it's been resurrected. And since we have a great high priest over the house of God, let us approach with a true heart and with full assurance of faith, our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. And so we've read that sprinkled clean whenever we talked about the sprinkling of the blood,
mm-hmm.
That allowed them to ascend the mountain.
Yeah.
Right. And now he's bringing in the curtain in Hebrews and talking about how we, through the flesh of the Messiah, that has died and has been resurrected. He resurrected in the flesh. We have access to God,
mm-hmm.
In a way that we've never had before. And so, anyways, I think that's really cool. So, anyways, all of this, I'm gonna close out with this little line. This is a section from Peter Enns's commentary on Exodus. In talking about the tabernacle, he says, "In the midst of a fallen world, an exile from the Garden of Eden, the original heaven on earth, God undertakes another act of creation, a building project that is nothing less than a return to pre-fall splendor. The tabernacle, therefore, is laden with redemptive significance, not just because of the sacrifices and offerings within its walls, but simply because of what it is, a place of holy ground amid a world that has lost its way. If this is a correct understanding of the tabernacle, we begin to see why the writer of Exodus devotes so much space to its description."